How's the sound? Okay. As some of you know, Matthew Tewari and I were in the teacher training together. Namo Quan Chu Yin Pu Sa. Namo, 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 Namo Quan Chu Yin Pu Sa. Namo Quan Chu Yin Pu Sa. And in our training together, usually in the evenings, we would chant and we would sing and move together. And the one chant that we would return to over and over again that was a real touchstone for us was this choral version of the Kuan Yin chant. It had multiple parts, like maybe 4, 5 different parts. So we had to really harmonize and listen to each other, be present with each other. I remember there was one session during our training that was really challenging. And we just instinctively knew that we needed to chant, that we needed to chant together, we needed to move together. Just to come back into some harmony, to come back into some balance. It was really soothing. The chant itself was soothing. Just coming together and bringing our voices together and harmonizing and chanting together was quite a calming and soothing. Because it was a way of connecting with Kuan Yin, and through connecting with Kuan Yin together, we were summoning our own compassion to help us be steady and tender together in what was a really challenging kind of point for us. This is what I love about compassion, is that once you have a felt sense of it, you can call it up with a phrase, an image, a chant, or even a somatic sense. So for many years, I sat with a teacher who would encourage this calling up of compassion through a somatic sense by just encouraging you to put a hand on your cheek so you could feel your own tenderness. Right there for us, this compassion, if only we remembered our hearts like profound and vast capacity to meet the turbulence of life with this tenderness, with this care. So I want to explore compassion tonight because it can be a real ally and balm and companion for us. Walk through us with our lives. It can be a. We can carry it in our heart. It can help us navigate the challenging times, the spirit of our times that we're living in now. And I also want to explore compassion because it's one of the expressions of a free heart and mind. So there are a lot of different realms that are described in the suttas. And one of them is ours, this dukkha plane that we live in. dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of conditioned experience, but also just the pain of pain. And when we don't actually have compassion as an ally to help us navigate the challenges, to help us navigate the unsatisfactoriness and the pain, dukkha can start to gradually wear away at our well-being. And I've shared this quote with you before, but I want to share it again because it speaks to the immensity of dukkha. Because of the immensity of dukkha, it speaks to our need to open to dukkha gradually in stages. Now, this is from Joseph. It's said that the reason enlightenment happens in stages is because we don't have the capacity all at once to open to the first noble truth of dukkha, of the suffering, of the unreliable nature of things. Compassion helps us to open to this first noble truth of dukkha without being overwhelmed, without being kind of toppled into despair or barricading the heart or rushing in to fix people and outer conditions. And that impulse to rush in and fix, usually born of a reactivity that thinks that we can't actually be with our own pain. Be with the pain of our loved ones. Just be with the pain of the world. Oh, when compassion isn't present, there are a number of ways that we react to dukkha. Part of maturing compassion is really getting to know within our own heart and mind, how do we react when dukkha hits? Do we bury our head in the sand? Is there a bracing or a freezing in the body? Do we live from the neck up? Do we just pretend that everything's okay? Are we struggling with life? Are we overanalyzing the dukkha? Are we trying to will our way out? Do we collapse into despair? Do we berate ourselves? As I mentioned days and days ago in a talk, that these reactions of the heart, there's nothing wrong with them. They come from a very innocent place. The heart is just saying, like, I need something to help me navigate all that a heart and a body are actually susceptible to. I need something that'll help me be at peace with everything that a heart is going to encounter, that my heart is going to encounter in a lifetime. Illness, and COVID and its various variants, and vaccines. Racial injustice, the all-out assault and dismissal of our queer gender friends and family, the loss of our loved ones, aging, the political fractures that we're living through, our ailing planet, just learning how to relate to these five aggregates. As Greg was saying last night, these five aggregates, we relate to them as if they're these static things that we then create a sense of identity around. And this is just my opinion, and no sutta support for this. I think the wish for peace that our hearts long for, coupled with this vulnerability of being alive, i.e. dukkha, can just feel so untenable. And we just don't feel that we can bear the pain of that dissonance, the dissonance of the peace that we long for and being like right in the middle of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. And this wish for peace, coupled with this vulnerability of being alive, feels so untenable at times that out of the building blocks of our moment-to-moment experience, we create a sense of self. And the sense of self, it gives us a sense of stability, ground, some sense of agency amid everything that's changing and that's out of our control. We do actually need something to see us through dukkha. But instead of relying on this constructed sense of self that we feel needs protecting and defending, we can actually turn to compassion, actually call on compassion. One of the Buddha's instructions to us is to actually understand dukkha, not a heady intellectual understanding. We start with that. But then as we cultivate compassion, it actually starts to move into a more integrated, embodied understanding. But we can't actually understand dukkha if we're not willing to actually get close to it. And it's understandable that we don't want to get close to it because it's painful. And we think our reactivity is actually protecting us, but it actually precludes us from, it's like a field between us and the dukkha. We compound the kind of natural dukkha that's a part of life with our own reactivity. So we call on compassion to help us get close to the dukkha so that it can be understood. So karuna is a meditative development of compassion. The cultivation of meditative compassion is actually grounded in our ethical conduct. You can think of compassion as this wholesome intention that fuels our ethical, verbal, and bodily conduct. It's an expression of harmlessness, this compassion. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. Here, a noble disciple reflects thus, I shall abandon and abstain from the destruction of life. With the rod and weapon laid aside, conscientious and kindly, I shall dwell compassionate towards all living beings. This is the first precept rooted in compassion. Here, a noble disciple reflects thus, I shall abandon and abstain from the destruction of life. With the rod and weapon laid aside, conscientious and kindly, I shall dwell compassionate toward all living beings. Dwell compassionate, abide compassionate towards all beings. That can be a North Star for our life. Majjhima Nikaya expresses it in this way. One whose mind, all day and all night, takes delight in harmlessness, that there is a delight in harmlessness, a delight in compassion. Even though we're coming in contact with suffering, there's a delight and a joy that suffuses the compassion. Last night, Greg was talking about Ajahn Buddhadasa and Nibbana, awakening, this cooling out. And each of you have had a foretaste of Nibbana. And I know some of you are thinking, she is so wrong. My mind ain't nowhere near Nibbana. But you have. You actually have. You have. For real, you have. Ajahn Buddhadasa talks about a temporary nibbana. Temporary nibbana. It's temporary cooling out. So this is from Ajahn Buddhadasa's Nibbana for Everyone. It's the small little pamphlet. He says, any reactive emotion that arises ceases when its causes and conditions are finished. Although it may be a temporary quenching, merely a temporary coolness, it is still Nibbana, even if momentarily. So you've had this experience. Recognize it. Trust in it. In the practice meetings, you've been coming in talking about tranquility, peace, contentment, being absolutely at ease, right? And wondering if you're doing it right, because there's not as much turbulence. You're actually in the terrain of the third noble truth, the cessation of dukkha through letting go of craving. Actually learn to see and attune to and resonate with this temporary nibbana, this temporary cooling out. Trust it. So he says, any reactive emotions that arise cease when its causes and conditions are finished. Although it may be a temporary quenching, merely a temporary coolness, it is still Nibbana, even if only temporarily. Thus, there's a temporary Nibbana for those who can't yet avoid some defilements. It is this temporary Nibbana that sustains the lives of beings who continue hanging on to defilement. Check this out, I love this. Anyone who can see that if the egoistic emotions existed day and night without any pause or rest, no life could endure it. If such a life didn't die, it would go crazy and then die in the end. You ought to consider carefully the fact that life can survive only because there are periods when the defilements don't roast it. These periods outnumber the times when the defilements blaze. You have had moments of temporary nibbana. Trust them. Recognize them. Attune to them. Get to know them. Savor them. They are onward leading. These temporary moments of nibbana, this craving, the interplay of greed, aversion, and delusion, they're dormant. You've experienced this in your daily lives and on retreat. The heart is not inflamed, the system is not agitated, there's peace. And when a heart is just like resting, just resting in this third noble truth, it's like the beautiful qualities of the heart, like compassion, can shine through. When the heart is actually empty, and what I mean by empty is it's empty of the activity of greed, aversion, and delusion, the compassionate response of the heart can just move through in this unabashed way, like filling our intentions, our words, our actions, our bodies, our hands, blessing ourselves, blessing anyone that we come in contact with. And the suttas make it clear that while abiding in compassion, and that's whether compassion is aroused through the phrases or the radiating practice, that just abiding in compassion itself is a temporary liberation of the heart and mind. When and we abide in compassion, it has this boundless quality, as in like no limits. And because the activity of greed aversion have abated, i.e. the heart mind is empty of craving, it's hard for the hindrances and the defilements to get a foothold. And this happens for us. We're abiding in compassion. The attention will land on something else for a moment, and the habit of some unskillful state will arise. And if we don't freak out, and we actually just meet that unskillful or that unwholesome state of mind with mindfulness in the field of compassion, and we don't fuel it, we actually can see it just dissipate right before our eyes. And it's like every time it happens, it's like magic. There's so much gratitude. Like, how is this possible? The suttas talk about compassion, actually all the Brahmaviharas, abundant. There's this wellspring that is just infinite, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without, can't be measured, boundless, no limits, no walls, no boundary. And it's so pleasant. There's a pleasant feeling tone in the compassion. I remember a yogi in a group practice meeting maybe a year and a half ago, maybe a little longer, called all of the Brahmaviharas a bomb. I think this speaks to their soothing and calming influence on our hearts and our minds. And I think one of the reasons abiding in compassion can be so soothing is because there's this delight. There's this joy in the compassion. So I'm going to read a passage for you from Bryan Stevenson's memoir. Just to give you a sense of who Bryan Stevenson is. He's an African-American civil rights attorney and activist. And through the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, and this is a monument to the victims of lynching, and it's also a memorial and a museum that takes you on the journey through slavery, through Jim Crow and mass incarceration. And Bryan Stevenson and his colleagues at the Equal Justice Initiative, through this memorial, are actually encouraging us as a nation, here in the United States at least, to reflect soberly on our history of racial discrimination and terror, but to do it in a way that's life-giving, to do it in a way where we're creating the conditions for a just and compassionate present and future for everybody. Everybody. For everybody. He has an immense intelligence rooted in an immense heart that cares for, that genuinely cares for the people that we as a culture here in the United States have relegated to the margins. He and his colleagues have argued 6 cases before the Supreme Court. And in our lifetime, I was shocked when I read this. And when I was preparing for the talk, I was like, is this true? Did we really do this? And I went back to check, like, yeah, we did. We used to sentence children, 17 and younger, for committing very egregious crimes, to death. But because of Bryan Stevenson and his colleagues at the Equal Justice initiative. We no longer do that. We're a little more just. We're collectively a little more compassionate, slowly, slowly inching our way towards making the 14th Amendment apply to all Americans. That's just to give you a sense of who this human is. So this is what Brian Stevenson said about what sounds to me like the flavor inherent in compassion. He said, when I was a college student, I had a job working as a musician in a black church in a poor section of West Philadelphia. At a certain point in the service, I would play the organ before the choir began to sing. The minister would stand, spread his arms wide and say, "Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice." Yeah. I love that. Because you get a felt sense of the joy that's inherent in compassion. And I know logically that sounds odd, because the cause for the arising of compassion is contact with the painful, with the challenging, with the difficult. And the focus of our mindfulness when cultivating compassion meditatively is not the suffering. It's actually the freedom from the suffering, the freedom from affliction, the vision of that. This is from Venerable Inalio's Emptiness and Compassion in Early Buddhism. It says, drawing a clear distinction between the realization that others are suffering and the wish for them to be free from suffering is important, since mentally dwelling on the actual suffering would be contemplation of dukkha, be a contemplation of the First Noble Truth. And this happens for us sometimes, right? We intend to cultivate compassion, but the mind focuses on the difficulty and the hardship of the situation instead, and our hearts start to resonate with the dukkha. And this would happen for me. Suffering would become the focus, and after some time, that would just wear away at my capacity to be mindful in a balanced way, and I'd fall out of balance, and then I'd need to practice equanimity. And I thought this whole cycle was practicing compassion. And I remember going into a practice meeting with Philip Moffitt during a 2-month retreat, explaining this whole thing to him. And he just looked at me and he said, "That's not compassion, sweetie. You're falling out of balance. There's joy in compassion." So in cultivating meditative compassion, the heart does come in contact with suffering. And then the focus widens to include not only the pain, but the vision of freedom from that pain. And it's the vision of freedom that's uplifting, that's joyous. When you meet Brian Stevenson, when you meet him, when you hear him speak, there's nothing downtrodden about this human. And he talks about being invigorated by his work. And I think he's that enthusiasm and that energy, that the fact that he's galvanized by it, is because at the center of his work is this vision of freedom. I think he's saying to us that no matter what our children do, no matter what our babies do, no matter how egregious, there's got to be another way. Instead of locking them away and throwing away the key, there's got to be another way. And that other way is this vision of freedom that is a joyous thing. So Brian Stevenson and his colleagues at the Equal Justice Initiative, after the Supreme Court ruled in their favor, they weren't celebratory. It was actually a moment of real soberness. And it was a moment of soberness because they realized that, okay, these children won't be executed, these young people won't be executed, but they'll be sentenced to die in prison. So he and his colleagues in the appropriate cases are actually working for their freedom. And this is what he said about just that work. He says, "It's so clear to me that we are all more than the worst thing we've ever done. I think if someone tells a lie, they're not just a liar. And they should not have to go through life branded only a liar. I think if someone takes something, they're not just a thief. I think even if you kill someone, you're not just a killer. We can't do justice until we understand all the things you are. We have a generation of kids, poor kids that by the time they're 5 have trauma disorders. What we're trying to do with these kids is that we're trying to make them feel human again. When you're told that you're a prisoner, when you're told that you're worthless, when you're told that you've been condemned to die in prison, you're basically being told that your life has so little meaning, so little purpose, so little value, we're not going to let you have that life." Can you hear the empathy in that? In this passage, you can hear Bryan Stevenson using his imagination in an ethical way, in a way that helps him empathize, come to understand from the inside what it must feel like for these children to be condemned. And what I mean by using the imagination in an ethical way, in a moral way, but if you prefer ethical, that's fine, is imagining our way into another person's circumstances to mitigate the reactivity in our own hearts so that we don't cause pain, so that we end the cycle of harm. Now, in his book on mindfulness, Joseph Goldstein talks about empathy being the beginning of compassion. So when we use our imagination towards an ethical purpose, towards an ethical end, empathy is actually conditioning compassion. Now, Bryan Stevenson goes on to say, "You know, for me, it's allowing people to be human despite the tragedy of a past crime, or despite the tragedy of the injustice, despite the tragedy of what we've done to people." When we let go of empathy, and therefore compassion, we divest people of their humanity. It is really easy to call people 3/5 of a human, vermin, basket of deplorables. When we stop using our imagination in an ethical way to cultivate empathy, we start to abandon each other. We start to reduce each other, and in that reduction, we can do egregious things to each other. We can sentence children to die. When did that become an option? So as the words of Bryan Stevenson kind of exemplify, and his life exemplifies, we make contact with suffering. We arouse our empathy through the use of our imagination in an ethical way. And then we allow sati to rest in this vision of freedom. And then we take action. And that action is fueled by this. We take action if the conditions allow us to. And this is meditative compassion, or just the heart's wish for the heart's wish for freedom, fueling compassionate action. What the suttas called anukampa. There are some contemporary scholars and practitioners who consider the Buddha's 30 years of teaching as compassion in action, or compassionate action, this anukampa. And he actually talks about this in the suttas, which is the Buddha's words. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and compassion and has compassion for them, that I have done for you. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. When I first heard this, I was like, that sounds kind of grim. Meditate, do not delay, or else you will regret it later. But from the perspective of compassion, this instruction is just, it's just full of this wish of, the Buddha's wish for freedom, for everyone that he came in contact with who resonated with these teachings. So it could be really easy to just focus on this vision of freedom out of aversion to suffering. That's not what we're intending to cultivate with compassion. That's just aversion to suffering, or that's aversion to suffering masquerading as compassion. Yeah. This is from, again, Venerable Anālaya's Emptiness and Compassion in early Buddhism. The meditative cultivation of compassion can only lead to deeper concentration if it is undertaken with a positive, even joyful mind. From a practical perspective, this means that one's cultivation of compassion needs to steer clear of sadness. This should ideally proceed from the opening of the heart that is genuinely receptive to the pain and suffering of others. The state of compassion arises out of this steady, honest encounter with dukkha. Brian Stevenson talks about getting proximate. And what he means by getting proximate is just getting close to dukkha. He talks about proximity changing him. So the state of compassion arises out of proximity with suffering. And then out of care and concern, a genuine wish to reduce suffering just fills the heart. Fills the heart. At the beginning of the retreat, I think it was our first metta session, I let you all know that I was raised by my mama, my auntie, and my grandmama. I like to say my mama was my mama, my auntie was my mama, and my grandmama was my mama. We had this habit in our family of calling people by their first and middle name, and you just kind of mush them together. Don Nicole, Trudy Elaine, Charles Edward, and Barbara Ann. My auntie was Barbara Ann, but I called her Auntie B for short. Did I tell you a little bit about her in that session? Just a little. She had a real body sense of humor. I can't even share some of the jokes here with you. In the last years of her life, she gave my mom and I the gift of caring for her, and this wasn't an easy gift for her to give us because she was very independent. And there are times when she was in pain, and my mom and I could like help kind of reduce that pain. And then there were times when we couldn't even do that. However, just being with her lightened the burden of the pain and the mental anguish that can come from being in physical pain, because she wasn't alone in her pain and she wasn't alone in her dying. And this in itself is compassion. We may not be able to take the suffering away, but just by being present, we can help lighten the burden of the anguish, of the difficulty. I remember one time my auntie and I, we were just coming back from one of her mammogram appointments. And it was looking like she had breast cancer. I remember the both of us were stunned, disheartened. It was like on top of everything that she was dealing with. Gastroparesis, diabetes, blindness, not being able to walk, having difficulty walking. On top of all of that, breast cancer. So we were at a stoplight. She was sitting in the passenger seat. You know when someone's really down, and they just physically collapse and their spine kind of makes that C shape. She's just shaking her head. Shaking her head. And I have no idea where this came from because I am not a very humorous person in challenging circumstances. But I said, Auntie B, everybody's dying. But right now, you're doing it a lot louder and faster than anybody I know right now. And she laughed. And I laughed. I think part of one of the reasons I laughed was just to see her light, her lightness in the midst of everything that she was losing. All of her capabilities that were slipping away from her. All this loss, and we were laughing. Laughter, kinship, in the midst of the dukkha. Make me to hear joy and gladness that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. Developing meditative compassion has a feels good. There are so many benefits. This is, again, from Venerable's Compassion and Emptiness. From an early Buddhist viewpoint, to cultivate compassion does not stand in conflict with withdrawing into meditative seclusion. As long as one's motivation comprises the aspiration to benefit others, regularly retreating for dedicated practice is certainly an integral part of the cultivation of compassion. And I bring this in because from time to time, I know my own heart will ask, like, what are you doing? Why are you on retreat 2 to 3 months a year, like, with COVID and all the challenges of our times, is this the best use of my time? Is this the best use of my resources? When there's so much hardship and pain in my immediate community, is this the best use of my time? And the practices that we're doing prepare our hearts for compassionate action in the world. It feels to me that there are like three channels for the or movement of compassionate action in the world. One is collective compassionate action, what we see with Black Lives Matter and the civil rights movement. And we call it a civil rights movement, but Vincent Harding reminds us that this was about beloved community. It was about remembering that we're in relationship with each other, and that relationship is one of mutuality and belovedness. And that if there's a rupture in that, that you can come back into right relationship. It's not easy, but it's possible. And if it wasn't for that vision of freedom, I would not be here right now. So there's collective compassionate action. Then there's the personal. We experience it from time to time, or a moment-to-moment experience. I experience with Auntie B. And then there's the life mission, exemplified in the life of someone like Bryan Stevenson. And he talks about the moment that compassionate action animated him. It animated his life. He says, I went to law school because I was concerned about inequality and injustice. And it didn't seem like those were priorities in my first year of law school. And it was really only in my second year of law school that things turned around. I drove down to Jackson, Georgia, which is where death row is. And they brought this man in, and he had chains everywhere. And they had to unchain this man. And I got so nervous that when he walked over to me, I said, I'm so sorry. I'm just a law student. I don't know anything about the death penalty. I don't know anything about criminal procedure. But they sent me down here to tell you that you're not at risk of execution anytime in the next year. And I will never forget that man just slowing me down and saying, wait. Say that again. And I said, you're not at risk of execution anytime in the next year. And he closed his eyes and he said, wait, say that again. And he said, and I said, you're not at risk of execution anytime in the next year. And that's when that man grabbed my hand and he looked me dead in the eye and he said, Thank you. And I couldn't believe how even in my ignorance, just being present, just showing up can make a difference in the quality of someone's life. And it taught me something really important about being present, about proximity. And this man started to sing. I'm pressing on the upward way, new heights I'm gaining every day, still praying as I'm onward bound, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. And when I heard this man sing, everything changed for me. That's when I knew I wanted to help condemned people get to higher ground. There isn't a right way. To act compassionately in the world, for compassionate action to roll through us. Joseph Goldstein talks about there not being a hierarchy of compassionate action, because the field of compassionate action is just suffering human hearts and beings. The way compassionate action will move through you will be an expression of your gifts, your interest, your resources, like time and energy. The call is just to alleviate dukkha where we can with this vision of freedom that's joyous. And compassionate action has its roots in meditative compassion. All the practices that we've been doing here allow the heart's benevolence and care and compassion to just shine through. Yeah. This is from Gil Fronsdale, talking about how meditative practice shapes our relationship to the world, each other, ourselves. Doing this deep work and really arriving here, being interested in here, discovering the samadhi, the settledness, this happiness, this contentment, the deep work of equanimity of just being here, transforms us into people who are peacemakers in this world. People who can step back into the world with compassion and care for the world in an important way. It's not an escape. What we're doing here is not an escape. It's a preparation, a sacred preparation for the sacred work of caring for each other in this world we live in. Let's just sit. Arriving here, just being interested in here.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.